You may be familiar with Leontief, the Russian economist who developed an input-output analysis. Leontief.
Yeah.
L-E-O-N-T-I-E-F-F.
Yeah.
Vasily Leontief. So he developed a type of input-output analysis that takes the entire economy, both physical and monetary, and puts it into cells so that everything balances off across the entire economy. Now, that was in a very managed economy, Russia, which was organized in a totally insane way, so that they produced everything over here of one kind and everything over here of another kind, the main reason being because it kept people from rising up. Because if they did, everything would shut down. So, I never saw such crazy people in my life. Anyway, I think it's possible that we change our modes of production and that we might be able to do without money on an assigned benefits basis. If we're going to be equal in all of the necessities and only vary slightly with respect to amenities and luxuries, where are we? We don't need too much money to do that. But we need
if
to do
money is, exists for the purpose of creating inequality. That it is a technology for that purpose.
I accept that.
Yeah, and that is my view of it. That's
I think
why
it may not have started that way, but it certainly ended up that way. I agree. Yes, sir.
Have you examined, according to the workings of Mondragon in Spain?
I am familiar with them. Yeah, I read, I did read a small book about them back in 1992.
The kibbutzim in Israel.
Excuse me?
The kibbutzim in Israel, which are
collective
cooperatives.
Yes.
Okay. They're non-state or direct democracy in terms of just all those things you're mentioning. And the scale is also empowers what you mentioned also. And I agree with you. That's a very viable way of proceeding.
Yes, I don't think that Mondragon is a perfect system, but I do think that they made advances, for example, in worker ownership and in participation. They still function in the regular outside market, which of course places distortions on everything that everybody does. And as for the kibbutzim, they were sort of destroyed over time by changes in Israel.
Yes.
But I thought that the original idea really had something to it.
Well, it's not completely destroyed. It does exist, it continues to exist, not with state power or anything, but it does exist. Yeah. It exists on
And I thought that that way of raising children was really fascinating. Thank you.
Yes. Have you heard of Twin Oaks here in this country?
I've heard it, but I don't know anything about it.
That's a intentional community of about 100 people that owns 400 acres free and clear, raises all their own food, and does the practices just what you're talking about.
How many people?
About 100.
That's a small community.
Yes. Very interesting.
It's a hub in Virginia.
Yeah, nice country. Yes, ma'am.
I like a lot of what you're saying, the idea of equality and so forth. I just wonder if there have been other attempts at it in the past, and what happened was those attempts to do this wherever it was in the world ended up being corrupt and evil. And look what happened in some of our countries where, we had genocide and ended up not being what it was supposed to be. How do we really make it happen, really making this happen?
It happened in the last century in this country, in a number of places. Upstate New York, there are many, many communities that justice seems has been underneath everything.
There was a whole community, a whole culture like that called the Haudenosaunee, in which everyone was equal, and it was not didn't become a tyrannical dictatorship. It was just assailed
from without by people with superior weapons.
There have been many different kinds of societies and cultures in world history in many different places. The dangers you speak about are extremely real. In order to do that, people have to educate themselves. They have to really work at it. They need an educational program, they need a spiritual program, and they have to commit. And you have to write down something in the nature of an organic law that all of the different communities can share without fighting over it. Those are very tall orders. I am not saying that this thing is going to be easy. That's why I'm talking about it. If it were easy, I wouldn't be bothering. I think that you're right on, that it's a terrible problem.
Statistics. Is that Lester Brown, World Watch? Is that what you said?
I get the sheet, yes. Yeah. I think he's a little bit over-optimistic, yes. I'm sorry. If you'd like to talk, if we have a little time to talk, we're about gone, but if anybody would like to talk, I think an excellent topic would be, how would you localize? How would you get us localized? Now, in the back of this, I have things about land trusts and so on. But if you want to start a discussion group, and you can start and say, you know, the price of oil and so on is going to keep going up. And if the dollar falls, pretty soon we won't have $5 gas. We won't have $9 gas. We may have $30 a gallon gas. At which point, it's much cheaper to walk. Now, what are the two systems that are hit by our inability to afford oil that's light, sweet crude? Two systems. One, agriculture. Our system of agriculture is simply a way of transforming oil into food. And it puts in about 10 to 12 times as much energy as it gets out in final product. All right? The other system is connected to that, that is totally dependent on light sweet crude, is trucking. We get our food today from corporate farms that are thousands of miles away. If you get hit by this kind of thing, you're gone. So this would be a very good time to start talking about localizing as fast as you can. You need to localize your food production and your forest products production. Because if you have those two, and you got two good hands, you're going to get bloody hands with a death like this, but you'll survive. It's better to survive with bloody hands than to die. Yes, ma'am.
Well, something that I've thought about this for a long time, and what I feel is it's very difficult to know where you need to go without knowing where you are. And therefore, I think it would be quite useful if people could, I call it the inventory, that you define a community, a geographical community, however you're going to do that. And once again, in the 12th century, I mentioned in a previous panel, farmers' markets were the only markets, and they were licensed by the crown, so we know where they were, because they had a policy every 7 miles, because that was the distance a farmer could come and go to market in a day, presumably in a horse and cart.
In England,
mm-hmm. Yes. So if we define some radius, or we want to do it by counties or townships or whatever divisions we have, then we go through an inventory. We see who is producing what food. You know, what is the relationship of forest, pasture, water? Who has solar panels? Who has windmills? Who has skills? Who knows how to work with metal? Who knows how to blah, 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 whatever it is, and come up with a come up with saying, well, these are our resources for survival. And then we can look at and say, how do we augment them? What are we lacking? And you know, how can we deploy them? Because, you know, look, people are talking about our food depends on oil, blah, blah, blah. We are surrounded, at least where I live, by a whole bunch of Mennonite communities. Their food doesn't depend on oil. Their transport doesn't depend on oil. Their food is beautiful. They are very happy. And of course, they do not live as self-sufficiently as they once did. They don't weave their own cloth. They go to Walmart and buy it. Since the 12th century or the 15th or the 18th, we've learned certain things. In 12th century England, the entire population of Britain was 2 million people. London, the largest city, was about the same size as Ithaca with all the students in. Coventry, a fairly large city at the time, was the same size as Watkins Glen, which is 2,000 people. And that was a good-sized city that had just about everything in it. That, you know, any kind of trade, people practicing trade, markets, even huge cathedrals, castles, and, you know, blacksmiths and whatever. So I don't think I'm so glad you brought up the population, because there are for people for whom, if you say anything about reducing population, they say, you're just collaborating with genocidal racists. And because to say anything about reducing population is interpreted as a code word for exterminating people in the global south or something. And I'm very frustrated by that because, you know, every creature in an ecosystem has to exist in an appropriate balance with all the other things and the resources it needs to live. And human beings are way out of control in terms of their ability to look, as you discussed. And I'm so glad you said that, because I literally, there's a wonderful, like, group of folks that run, like, they let, like, activist groups get different listservs and whatever. And they have, their collective has made, you know, rules about who can't and can't apply, because it's free. They just give it to you if, you know, they think that you're doing something worthwhile. Anybody that mentions population control is not allowed to have a list there.
We have a Catholic mother here. I can't read your name.
Joyce.
Yes.
And she's a sister with the Order of St. Francis of Assisi. I bet that she would surprise you, that she could be more rational than you think. I didn't say that we should kill babies.
No one does.
Yeah. All right? I didn't say that we should force people to have abortions. I didn't say anything like that. What I said was that we are going to have to close negative feedback loops, and we're going to have to hold people responsible for themselves. And Joyce, I wonder if you would care to comment.
Well, I think I hear what you're saying. Yes, certainly I would not be in favor of genocide or in any way killing babies or anything, which has happened in some societies. But when you look at the whole picture of what we're facing, you know, there could be other options, other ways of being more responsible and of doing what we need to do. Some of the things that you suggested about population moves and so forth, there are different things that we could do other than killing.
Better education, especially the young people and the people in the, you know, ages of breeding. We let them know what we're looking at. You know, if I had known years ago what I know now, I probably would have made many different choices. I have four children. I don't even know if I would have had children. I can't give them up. I mean, I love my children. But if I had known then what I know now, I probably would have chosen not to have any children.
And what we've all brought up here today is that the rate of change that we have experienced in our lifetimes and are experiencing right now has accelerated and accelerated and accelerated until now. I, for one, and I'm still pretty lively for my age, I can't grab onto it. I know where it's going. I know how fast it's going. I could give you numbers. But for me to try to grab onto it in an existential way inside of myself, it just hurts too much to go any further soon after I get started.
John Doscher, speaking on August 8th, 2009 in Alfred, New York at the New York Green Fest. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
John Svensson was a farmer. He grew the Minnesota wheat. Rode there with his daughter, high up on the thresher's seat. They broke down on the hillside, the radiator spitting steam. Went back to get the toolbox so they could fix the old machine. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, we can fix the tractor, we can make it like new. But that day they got a letter that said the power lines would come right across their farmland, right across the setting sun. So they gathered all the family and talked late into the night. We cannot let them do this. We've got to put up one hell of a fight. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, we'll apply a little pressure and we'll see what that will do. So they phoned 100 farmers and drove to the Twin Cities. Met there with the governor and they sued the utility. But after writing all the letters and paying all the legal costs to the power of the city, once again the farmers lost. And in the still of the evening, the wind is all you hear. I watch the waves on the wheat fields alone. I walk the furrows of earth I plant year after year. This is our land, this is our home. This is our land, this is our home. So they met there at the tavern, but there wasn't much to say. The power lines may come, but they will not stay. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, what was once put together, we can easily undo. With bandanas on their faces, careful not to make a sound, they loosened all the bolts that held the towers to the ground. several weeks later, with nobody around, the Minnesota wind blew tower after tower after tower down with the turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw. What was once put together, we can easily undo. This is our land, this is our home. This is our land, this is our home. This is our land, this is our home.
Came across an article that resonated with me after hearing John's description of what is happening to the oceans. A report on Agence France-Presse, filed from Ottawa, stated that millions of salmon have mysteriously failed to turn up in a Canadian river as part of their annual spawning, leaving experts baffled and the local fishing industry in despair. They had projected that between 6 and 10 million sockeye salmon would return to the Fraser River this month. But the official count for the annual summer run, which is usually almost over by now, is just 600,000. So a 90% or more reduction in salmon. That's called a crash. And apparently, a record number of salmon offspring were born in the Fraser in 2005 and migrated to the ocean. Most of them should have returned by now to spawn. The government officials are making no comments, but ecologists have speculated that the salmon could have been affected by warmer ocean temperatures, fewer food sources, or the killing of juvenile salmon by contracting sea lice and other infections from some 30 fish farms they would have encountered as they migrated out to sea. Wild salmon are under threat in many rivers of the North Pacific and North Atlantic because of overfishing at sea. Here's another question. The normal territories that those salmon occupy, if there has been a 90% reduction in population, are those places likely to become new sites of uneaten plankton sinking to the bottom of the ocean and creating methane explosions. John also mentioned that his sources said there may be as many as 200 of these exploding methane sites. Could any of them have been in the home territory of the salmon? A methane explosion the size of New Jersey underwater could easily kill 6 million fish. Consider what an explosion the size of New Jersey would do to the population of New Jersey and the eastern seaboard. It would kill way more than 6 million people. These are just my speculations, but I couldn't help thinking it when I saw this article. Last week in our reading from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises, It's Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein, we began Chapter 7, The Age of Reunion, and left off in a discussion of demurrage currency, a monetary system that encourages generosity rather than greed, because it maintains the medium of exchange function of money, but discourages the store of value function that leads to accumulation. In the present interest-based money system, Eisenstein wrote, security comes from having, from accumulation, and its consummation is financial independence. Yet the original affluence of the hunter-gatherer sprung from a security associated not with independence, but interdependence. Remember the piraha, I store meat in the belly of my brother. A lone human can survive in the wild, but his or her existence is far more precarious than that of a cooperating group. Demurrage currency, he wrote, recreates the hunter-gatherer's disinclination toward material accumulation, inducing perhaps the same mentality of trust in a providential universe that existed in those days. The Age of Reunion, Eisenstein then says, is a return to an original psychology of abundance, yet at a higher order of complexity. It's not a technological return to the Stone Age, as some primitivists envision after the collapse, but a spiritual return. And so we continue. Silvio Gesell, the originator of the demurrage idea, foresaw that it would spark a profound change in attitudes towards money. With the introduction of free money, money has been reduced to the rank of umbrellas. Friends and acquaintances assist each other mutually as a matter of course with loans of money. No one keeps or can keep reserves of money, since money is under compulsion to circulate. And just because no one can form reserves of money, no reserves are needed, for the circulation of money is regular and uninterrupted. No longer would money be a scarce commodity, hoarded and kept away from others. Rather, it would tend to circulate at the maximum possible velocity. The government would ensure stable prices according to the equation of exchange, MV equals PQ, by regulating the amount of currency in circulation, M, to correspond to total economic output, Q. The same result could be achieved by linking the currency to a basket of commodities whose level corresponds to overall economic activity, as proposed by Bernard Leiter. As Gesell concludes, quote, it follows that demand no longer depends on the whim of the possessors of money, that price formation through demand and supply is no longer affected by the desire to realize a profit. The demand is now independent of business prospects and expectations of a rise or fall of prices, independent, too, of political events, of harvest estimates, of the ability of rulers, or the fear of economic disturbance. Close quote. Free money would eliminate much of the source of our society's endemic economic anxiety. Can you imagine a world in which money were not scarce? How would your own life be different if you felt no compulsion to accumulate money for security's sake? In a world where survival depends on money and where money is scarce, then survival too is hard, and security only won by outcompeting everyone else. In a demurrage-based currency system, even though the total amount of currency would be determined by the issuer, its dynamics would ensure a sufficiency for all. The contradiction in today's economy, in which a surfeit of material goods is coupled with their grossly unequal distribution, so that some remain always in want, will disappear, as would the feedback cycle that leads to economic recession and depression. Perhaps it would also address the deeper contradiction in which, on the one hand, there are hundreds of millions of people who are unemployed or engaged in trivial, meaningless jobs, while on the other hand, there is much necessary, meaningful work left undone, a disconnect between human creativity and human needs. With free money, demand is inseparable from money. It is no longer a manifestation of the will of the possessors of money. Free money is not the instrument of demand, but demand itself, demand materialized and meeting on an equal supply footing, which always was and remains something material. Close quote. From Plato onward, utopian philosophers thought that reason, planning, and method would bring the same progress to the social realm as material technology brought to the physical. Social planning would conquer the wilderness of human nature, just as technology subdued the wilderness of physical nature. The failure of both is seen merely as evidence that we need more of the same. The ambition of nanotechnology to extend physical control to a new level of microscopic precision parallels the social techniques of education and law as they strive toward ever finer regulation of human behavior. The greed that leads us to ignore good and necessary work in favor of narrow self-interest is not a fundamental pillar of human nature, but an artifact of our money system and of our misconception of self and world that underlies it. Our system's built-in scarcity has conditioned us to believe that we cannot afford to act from love, to do fulfilling work, to create beauty. Gesell's free money represents a liberation from these constraints and from the delusions of self underlying them. It lays down a structural incentive for generosity and frees creativity to seek out need. In this regard, free money represents a return to the gift-based societies of yore. Notice its amazing congruity to Lewis Hyde's description of the dynamics of gift flow. Quote, "The gift moves toward the empty place. As it turns in its circle, it turns toward him who has been empty-handed the longest. And if someone appears elsewhere whose need is greater, it leaves its old channel and moves toward him. Our generosity may leave us empty, but our emptiness then pulls gently at the whole until the thing in motion returns to replenish us. Social nature abhors a vacuum." Close quote. Free money reverses a compulsion to constantly expand and fortify the accumulation of the private, that is, to expand and fortify the separate realm of self, me, and mine. Free money creates a structural impetus toward the universal brotherhood proclaimed by Jesus and progressively demolished by the church, and banished completely from the material world by Martin Luther. Just as interest shrinks the circle of self until we are left with the alienated ego of modern civilization, demurrage the negative of interest, widens it to reunite us with community and all humanity, ending the artificial scarcity and competition of the age of usury. We live, after all, in a world of plenty, and we always have. The present money system, and underneath it, the enclosure of the wild into the exclusively owned, has created artificial scarcity where none need exist. Half the world goes hungry, while the other half wastes enough to feed the first half. It is not food nor any other necessity that is scarce. It is money, whose built-in scarcity induces the same in everything else. A negative interest currency is a step back toward the gift economies of yore, described in Chapter 4, that literally creates ties, obligations. Describing Lewis Hyde's theory of the gift, author Jessica Prentice writes, quote, "Part of the sacred erotic energy of gifts is that the receiver cannot accumulate them. Either a gift needs to be passed on, or another gift needs to be given, so that the gift-giving energy keeps moving. Gifts are about flow, and they are meant to circulate," close quote. This is a perfect description of free money, which, like a gift collecting dust in the closet, loses its value when kept unused. In a free money system, monetary transactions become like the exchange of gifts, because money is no different from any other object. Another type of money that addresses the scarcity problem even more directly is the mutual credit system, often going by the acronym LETS, Local Exchange Trading System. In a mutual credit system, money is not created by banks or by a central issuer, but is generated by the transaction itself. Here's how it works. Suppose Jane needs someone to mow her lawn. Joe agrees to do it for 10 LETS dollars, and the transaction is recorded on the computer or other ledger. Jane's account is debited by $10 and Joe's credited by $10. If both started with a balance of zero, now Jane has minus 10 and Joe has 10. Money is created out of nothing. Now Joe can use these 10 LETS dollars to buy some other good or service from Fred. Jane, meanwhile, owes the community $10 worth of some other service. If the above scenario seems unsound, understand that its money creation mechanism is in essence no different from the present bank debt system. When a bank lends you $100,000 for a mortgage, it essentially creates the money out of nowhere. As in the LETS system, debt and money are, as Leiter puts it, two sides of the same coin. The important difference lies in the way in which the creation of money is regulated. In our present system, money creation is constrained by 1. Margin reserve requirements, 2. The credit worthiness of the borrower, which means her ability to outcompete others to pay back the loan principal and interest. As described in Chapter 4, these constraints often lead to a scarcity of money because they are not directly connected to demand for a medium of exchange. They can also lead to a polarization of wealth when the means of wealth production, capital, is available at higher cost or not at all to precisely those people who already lack the means of wealth production to pay back interest. In contrast, LETS money creation is typically governed by the community. In theory, there is nothing preventing Jane from going deeper and deeper into debt with no intention of ever paying it back, and nothing to prevent Joe and Fred from recording fictitious transactions to build up Fred's credits as Joe skips town. But in practice, anyone who does this will eventually be refused service by the community. LETS currency represents a formalization of "I owe you one," where "you" is not the individual who performed the service, but rather the community. It relies on social pressure, both overt and internalized, in the form of duty, shame, and so on, to prevent abuse of the system. Someone is only permitted to run up huge debits if they and the community feel circumstances warrant it, in the event of illness, for example. Because money is created by transaction, there is never a shortage of currency in a let system. The simple willingness to perform a needed service or provide a needed good is enough to make a transaction take place, in contrast to the present contradiction-ridden system that often fails to connect the underemployed and the underserved. With a non-scarce currency, no one ever lacks the money to pay for what they need. Of course, needs are still determined by culture and community, which might be unwilling to provide what a person wants. The important thing is that it is indeed the community that makes the judgment and not the impersonal, anonymous forces of economics. In this way, Letts brings back the ancient customs of reciprocity that once held communities together. In addition to quantifying individuals' contributions to the community, Letts and other local currency schemes draw communities closer together by keeping the economy local. Local currencies ameliorate and can even reverse the ruthless pressures of the global economy, which effectively pits everyone in competition with everyone else. Few of the supermarkets in Pennsylvania sell the apples which grow so abundantly here, importing them instead from the West Coast or even New Zealand. Local dairy farmers go bankrupt, while consumers drink milk from Michigan or Wisconsin. Traditional economics says that that is because these out-of-state producers are more efficient, enjoying a comparative advantage arising from land, climate, or culture. The truth is often that this, quote, efficiency comes from a more effective externalization of costs. Subsidized inputs of water, transportation infrastructure, and environmental capacity to absorb waste artificially reduce the cost of the imports, whose price reflects none of these externalized costs. While local economies can also suffer from externalities, it is less likely because the payers of the externalized costs are usually within the same community that supports the business. A business that relies solely on an impersonal remote commodities market for all its raw materials and sales has little investment in its locality and therefore little incentive to act responsibly. Besides externalization of costs, another reason for the higher efficiency of large external producers is that they exploit greater economies of scale than are possible at a local level. Unfortunately, the flip side of an economy of scale is uniformity and standardization. Increasingly, today's economy is dominated by national or global corporations providing uniform products and services over vast areas. One sector of the economy after another has succumbed to the business model exemplified by Walmart. Long gone are the independent grocers, bakers, hardware stores, clothing stores, and burger joints of yesteryear, replaced by and large by corporate franchises. The result has been a homogenization of culture, cuisine, and urban landscape throughout North America, and to some extent globally, the landscape of the exit ramp. You know what it looks like. Ugh. Mile after mile of fast food restaurants, gas stations, automobile dealerships, big box stores, and shopping centers. No fast food franchise opens a store to contribute to the community, only to extract wealth from the community, to be sent eventually to faraway headquarters or shareholders. Local currencies counter this dynamic because they can only be used locally. If a grocery store, say, decides to accept partial payment in local currency, It must find a use for that currency locally. By sourcing products from local farmers and perhaps by paying a portion of salaries in local currency as well. A national chain is less likely to attempt this, opening the door to local competition. The result is a self-reinforcing virtuous circle, because local suppliers and employees paid in local currency must themselves use it locally. The more business and consumers who use it, the more useful it becomes, and the greater the incentive for businesses to accept it. The most profound effect of the currency systems described above is probably psychological. Currencies that are not defined by interest and scarcity resurrect the ancient hunter-gatherer mentality of abundance, in which sharing is easy and natural, in which there is no mad scramble to enclose the world in me and mine. As such, it is consistent also with a more open conception of self, defined by relationships and not by absolute boundaries of self and other. Consequently, while none of these currencies will ever truly supplant our present system unless our self-definition changes, they are nonetheless an agent of change that can help to induce the reconception of self and world. When the convergence of crises hits that marks the turning point into a new era, the financial crisis, which we can see building today, and let me add this was written 3 years ago, will clear the way for all the ideas laid out above to crystallize into a radically different system. When this happens, money, ever a force for evil, will come to embody a new set of incentives aligned with the priorities of the connected interdependent self, sustainability, beauty, and wholeness. Is it too much to imagine an economy in which the best business decision is identical to the best ecological decision? In which there is a built-in economic incentive, as opposed to a regulatory compulsion, to protect the environment? In which the creative entrepreneurial energy of business is constitutionally aligned with the wholeness of nature and the health of society? As Gazelle puts it, quote, money, anathema throughout the ages, will not be abolished by free money, but it will be brought into harmony with the real needs of economic life. Free money leaves untouched the fundamental economic law, which we showed to be usury, but it will cause usury to act like the force that seeks evil but achieves good. Close quote. As it stands, money is almost universally recognized as a force for evil, or even the root of all evil. The locution cannot afford to reveals just how often money is an impediment to our innate tendencies toward kindness, generosity, leisure, and creativity. As I have described, interest money generates the greed that we mistake as human nature and perpetuates the illusion that security and wealth come from gathering more and more of the world unto self, carving out a larger and larger exclusive province of me at the expense of every other living person, animal, plant, and ecosystem. As well, it seems to directly contradict the teaching of karma, which says that what we do to the world, we do to ourselves. In our current money system, giving out to the world means less for me, not more. Money thereby contributes to the illusion of separateness that is considered in Buddhism and arguably in other religions too to be the root of all suffering. Free money and let systems reverse this role and bring money into line with karma, reinforcing rather than denying its fundamental principle that by enriching the world, we enrich ourselves. In so doing, they also subvert the dogma of the discrete and separate self that underlies the development of the present money system. A harbinger of the convergence of crises, and in this case especially the financial crisis, occurred in the 1930s and began to generate precisely the types of money systems I've been describing. However, at that time, not all the elements of the convergence were in place. The modern conception of self and world had not reached its full maturity. In the 1930s, in the wake of the generalized currency collapse throughout much of the world, thousands of local currencies appeared throughout North America and Europe, named emergency currencies in the United States. They incorporated various of the features described above and rejuvenated local economies wherever they were instituted. They worked so well that one of the leading economists of the time, Irving Fisher, advocated the stamp-scrip demurrage system as a way out of the Great Depression. The correct application of stamp-scrip would solve the Depression crisis in the U.S. in 3 weeks, close quote. Other economists agreed, but pointed out to Treasury Undersecretary Dean Acheson possible decentralizing political effects. President Roosevelt responded by banning all emergency currencies, choosing instead the centralized solution of the New Deal. A similar story transpired in Austria with the Wurgel currency and its numerous imitators described above, as well as in Germany a few years before. Today, though most countries now tolerate complementary currencies, they still suppress them through a variety of means. For example, local currency income for professional services is still subject to income taxes, which must be paid in the national currency, thus forcing people to operate substantially in the non-local economy. Apparently, the world was not yet ready for a shift of power to local communities. The centralized solutions represented by the New Deal and by fascism in Europe represent more than just maneuvers for political power, but are part and parcel of the mentality of control, top-down engineering, and reductionistic thinking. The zeitgeist of the time dictated such solutions. In Newtonian science, one does not simply allow a solution to grow, but engineers one from above. From Keynesian pump priming to fascism, we will make the trains run on time. The economic solutions chosen during the Great Depression all involved central authority, the social counterpart of the discrete and separate subject on one level, and of humanity vis-à-vis nature on another, taking control and imposing order upon a broken machine. No matter that the centralized solutions were not in fact effective. While the New Deal did manage to rescue people from utter destitution, the Depression only ended with the military buildup and conflagration of World War II. That wartime economy has been with us ever since. A similar choice faces us today and will intensify in clarity as the financial crisis grows more severe. Again, we will have to decide between, on the one hand, more centralized, top-down control, leading as it did in the 1930s to fascism and war, and on the other hand, a release of control to a more organic solution. From the central government perspective, it is not a solution at all, not in the sense of a design or plan. Local currencies have sprung up spontaneously and with similar characteristics again and again. Those of the Great Depression were preceded by currencies of similar design during the panics of 1873, 1893, and 1907. We are deeply habituated to thinking that a solution means more control, more detailed measurement of all the variables, a more comprehensive design. This is the technological program applied in this case to currency. But just as in other areas of technology, the illusion of monetary control, so compelling in the last 60 years, due to the absence of major financial panic, at least in the West, is wearing thin. Soon its failure will be undeniable, and we will have to decide whether to deny it anyway, at a higher and higher price, or let go and trust the wild, the spontaneous creativity of human communities. The longer we hang on, the harder we scramble to apply one technical fix after another to our tottering money system. The more severe the crisis and its subsequent dislocation will be. The eventual result is assured, though, that a new system of money will emerge that is aligned with the priorities of the connected, interdependent self, sustainability, beauty, and wholeness. Money in the age of reunion will be an agent for the development of social, cultural, natural, and spiritual capital, and not their consumption. It will be a mechanism for the sharing of wealth and not its accumulation. It will be a means for the creation of beauty, not its diminishment. It will be a barrier to greed and not an incentive. It will encourage joyful creative work, not necessitate jobs. It will reinforce the cyclical processes of nature, not violate them. Quoting again Patrick Farley's Visionary Future, could you or I believe how fantastically wealthy they all became? We can now see what this might mean. When wealth is separate from accumulation, but refers to a richness of relationships, each person's wealth makes everyone wealthier. Art, the creation of beauty, will no longer be limited by what we can afford, for money will be art's ally, not its enemy. Business will be the seeking of ways to bestow wealth upon others, rather than the stripping of wealth from others. No longer, then, will our lives be full of cheap stuff and every transaction a rip-off. Work will no longer be bound to the search for money, but we will seek out ways to best serve each other and the world, each according to our unique gifts and temperament. That will be self-evidently the way toward riches, both spiritual and financial, for no longer will the two be in conflict. And I've been reading from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That is Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. You can read ahead or download this entire book online, as well as find out other information about the author on the web at ascentofhumanity.com, ascentofhumanity.com. And you can download a copy of this program and all previous episodes on the web at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you so very much for listening.
One day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my